first session in this series, When Life Doesn't Go Your Way, Lessons in Forced Surrender.
Thank you so much for your wonderful introduction. And I thank all of you for attending this amazing Zoom call. I have seen a few known faces, amongst them Priya from the Metropolitan Museum, at least the time I knew her. I was visiting there. I have seen also Dayal and of course the Upbuild steering team. And I'm very delighted to offer these five lessons on this quite important subject, because sometimes what we consider our greatest obstacle does turn into our greatest opportunity. In other words, when things don't go our way in life, it might well be that this is an opportunity craved for, prayed for, thought after in many, many, many lonely hours of prayers. I will tell stories from my own life, and I will then offer some reflection and takeaways, and I do hope that I will reach with my words the core of your heart so that I can really leave an impression that is worthwhile for you. Let me just say one brief prayer to invoke auspiciousness, and then I will take a big leap into the subject matter. Om Ajanati Mirandasya Gyananjala Salakaya Shakshun Militam Yenai Tasmai Shri Gurave Nama. I had prepared this journey for perhaps 15 to 20 years in my life. It was a journey to the four main sacred places in the higher Himalayas. They are called the Char, or Four Dhams, or sacred places. There is something special about this traditional pilgrimage. When you complete one holy place, reach one holy place, I started with the source of the Ganga River, Gangotri. Then there is already tremendous benefit. When you can complete the second journey to the second holy place, for me this was Yamunotri, the source of the sacred river Yamuna, then the benefit increases more than double, three or four times. But then when you can complete the third and the fourth of these four chadams, there is no mathematical calculation what is the benefit. So I had gone through three out of these four sacred places. It had been difficult. I was in Gangotri and took my bath in the ice cold Ganga as it comes out of the glacier. It is so cold it would freeze if it wouldn't have so much momentum in the flow. I had further gone to the source of the Yamuna and had found these super hot springs. I went up to Kedarnath, the place where there is a self-manifested shrine of Lord Shiva. That was the most difficult of all journeys. I remember it started to snow. Many of the pilgrims had gone with mules up. They had these mules carried palanquins because it was just too difficult to continue walking for them. But I had walked, my feet were wet, and I had reached Kedarnath and had been able to change into, from my dirty clothes, which were full of the remnants of the mules' digestions. You know, the mules, they, how do you say this in polite English? They relieve themselves of nature's call, and the ground becomes just brown, a brown, muddy thing. So the cloth was very dirty. But I had managed to change in the midst. When I was changing, there were about these seven powerful mountain dogs who stared at me and gnarled at me, but I had completed my dress code and went into the temple. Now only one sacred place was left, Badrinath, the place of Lord Vishnu, where he touches the ground when he appears here in the world of mortal, of mortals. To go up to Badrinath, we had rented a jeep with a very good jeep driver. I remember he drove these curves, which are there in the mountain, and there is no fence, and just this much to the right is an abyss that is so steep that I don't recommend anyone to look down there, because you turn dizzy when you are not an able mountain climber or a skyscraper builder. So we had gone up to Badrinath, and there were signs of disaster on the road. We saw many buses which had fallen down the road. I know of such a bus where monks who were related to me were in, and where they had died when they crashed down. But what was even more disquieting than these bus skeletons down at the bottom of the abysses were the landslides which had happened. When a landslide happens in the Himalayas, earth comes down, rock comes down, and it comes on the road and either covers the road, which is an ideal case scenario, or it takes down the whole road, and it takes weeks, if not months, to again make reestablish the road. So I had seen a few of these dreaded mountain slides, and our driver said, "This is not an ideal time where we are traveling, because the monsoons have started, and that means when the monsoons started, there will be more landslides. But what to do? It was the only time we got free from our schedule in Europe, and we went. We made it to Badrinath. And I never forget the beautiful scenario in Badrinath. There was Nilagiri, the queen of the Himalayas, a snow-capped mountain that is contrasting towards the azure blue sky. There were the saints whom we visited in their caves, some of them very powerful and very accomplished. There was the cave of Vyasa, where the literary avatar of God composed the Vedas. There was the tantric who put a magic charm on me and called him so that I climbed up a mountain, which I would never have done, to see him in his cave. He said, "Thank you, I just wanted to see you. You may go now." There were many, many things, but the most wonderful of all experiences in Badrinath for me was when I finally, after this arduous journey, climbed these 20 or so steps and moved into the temple. My dear everyone, I felt really, when I stepped over the threshold and went into the temple complex, that my earthly journey had reached its completion. I was very, let me say, I was felt embraced by an atmosphere. I think when if a little child is embraced by the loving embrace of his mother, then for the child everything is okay. There are no questions of tomorrow. Will I get my food tomorrow or anything? It's perfect for the child to be in that embrace. So when an atmosphere can also embrace you like that, and you do not think about tomorrow in such an atmosphere. I was so perfectly happy in Badrinath because of visiting the temple twice a day that I forgot about the most important question for a traveler. Will I be able to travel down the mountain? Up the mountain was already, there were some premonitions, I think you say in English, some hints that we have entered into landslide era. When we stayed there for a week, and we could see when we looked down the mountains, we saw the heavy clouds underneath, and we know, ooh, the monsoon clouds have arrived. We were not affected because we were above the clouds. And my mind was not affected because I was embraced by how would you describe the divine embrace? The scriptures say it feels when you are in direct contact with the divine presence. It feels like you are relieved from burdens of old karma. To translate that into modern language, you are freed from your stuff, which everyone carries around. And you actually feel a delightful, sweet pulling in the heart, that a yearning, a longing, and strangely an arrival at the same time. It's not an unfulfilled longing. It's a longing that is mixed with an arrival. English language and also German language is not equipped really to express these things in a poignant way. Anyway, so yes, every day I went to that temple. Before, there was a hot basang, really hot. When I entered it, I felt like a potato, hoping that I would not be boiled. But I heard, I saw some pilgrims who had a cloth bag and inside potatoes, which they took it to this hot bassin where people take their bath. And I think they leave it a little longer than they stay inside, and it becomes soft. So I was every day in this bassin. No, I didn't catch anything. I was in a bathtub with the brooding humanity. There were so many people inside. And then I dried myself quickly in the very cold winds, and went up the steps into the temple where I saw that ancient deity. Anyways, our week, a most delightful week. I have written about it in a book called The Way of the Great Departure, came to an end. Our Jeep driver was still with us, and he said, maybe things won't go our way when we go down. He already had some information. So surely enough, we only drove for, I don't know, half an hour or so, and the first major landslide had just happened. There was still some, what do you call it, some rumbling in the air as the landslide built up tempo and built it and made an avalanche, but it was going down. Our road was blocked. So we asked the workers who arrived almost instantaneously, because they knew it was in the air, it was coming, how long will it take until the landslide is removed? And they said 10 minutes. You know, in India, 10 minutes could be 10 years. So we knew, okay, let's return and sleep in Badrinath and come back next morning. We came back next morning to that same spot. They were still working at it. It was taking them 3 days, but then the road was open and we went down. Only an hour later, we heard a terrible rumbling. Our driver put the gears back and pulled the car back, and I saw a beautiful, dangerous, fully equipped avalanche just going just before our car. And when it stopped, the road was covered with rocks, with the trunks of trees which were uprooted, and so on. Our driver said, this will take weeks before, or a week before it's done. So what we can do, he said, I know that you need to be back in Delhi to give your seminars. You don't have unlimited time. So why don't you cross the avalanche or the landslide by walking? Carry all your luggage. We can get some coolies or shepherds who help you carry your stuff, and then you go over it, and I can try to phone if I get a connection, so that a jeep comes from the other side to pick you up. He was a good man, an honest man. We paid him his fees, and we walked with the help of some mountain people who acted who were ready to carry against a small few people's luggages. That's how they make money. My dear everyone, I still remember something which is important for our lesson here. As I walked, I saw a coolie who had a big basket on the back, where there was an old man sitting inside. He carried an old man over the landslide. So I walked behind him and I looked at the old man who really was in discomfort for being carried. And I looked away at other things. And when I looked back, I saw the old man was no longer. He had died on the back of the coolie. So I quickly ran, tapped the coolie on the back and said, Mridyu, death. He put his basket down, looked at the old man, and he made that gesture, which is so, you can only have such a gesture in the Indian context. He has gone to the eternal world. From his gesture, I understood that happened frequently. And yes, I knew Badrinath as a sacred place is considered the dream of the pilgrim, anyone who goes there and returns. Well, sometimes not returns, has made it in life because of this spiritual benefit. That's the idea. But we didn't need to go down because of our seminar which we were giving. Many people were already registered and more were registering. So I continued. I went down. There was the jeep, but we had only driven for half an hour when another landslide stopped us. We tried to go around through the tough mountain roads, and because the idea is you just need to go down somehow, and you will find your way to Delhi and so on. But whatever we did, it seemed there were landslides stopping us. We finally gave up and understood things are not going to go our way. We chose a risky time, close and into the monsoon rains. This only God knows when we will get out of the Himalayas. It took some time to settle into being comfortable with surrendering that we wouldn't be able to go and give our seminars, or we wouldn't be able to do our plans. We would perhaps stay a month or two in the Himalayan mountains. And what it took to become comfortable were two very important understandings. One is to become free from, I gave it a name, from the destination illness. And the second was to understand not on what you cannot do at a given situation when things don't go your way, but what you can do now. And if you focus on that, you might discover your treasures. Let me speak about the destination illness, which is perhaps one of the most underdiagnosed illnesses of our time. It is feeling in our mind that only when I reach this particular goal, in my case, only if I complete the char dharms by going and coming back to the destination, to the point from where I started the pilgrimage, only then is my pilgrimage successful, or is my life successful. The destination illness has is there in everything. Only if I, for childless families, obtain a healthy male child will our family be graced with success. Only if I obtain, with the help of all these New Age gurus, my goal of making $1 million dollars profit, can I call myself a successful businessman. Only when I can raise this through Central Park, through this one route, in 2 minutes and 33.5 seconds, can I be a good runner. Only if my body has this much of muscles and so on. The destination illness. I will tell you about this illness a little bit, because, as I said, it's underdiagnosed. It's not recognized for many people, but it spoils their whole life and all their opportunities which wait outside. There was once a king, ancient story, wisdom story, who had a servant who was very joyful. Every morning the servant came in at the appointed time and woke the king with a eulogy. "Oh, your majesty, the world waits to see your blissful face." The king was all not at all blissful, he was. He would serve the king always with a happy smile, bring breakfast. No matter what went wrong, that servant or assistant was full of positive feelings. And then finally the king said to his minister, "His happiness gets on my nerves. He always comes in, he is so joyful, and I'm so up and down and often miserable. He gets on my nerves with his, 'Oh, good morning, Majesty. I could take a bow and an arrow and shoot it in his behind. I'm so unnerved by him.'" After about 10 times of complaining like this, the minister asked, "Would you like me to do something against this and make him miserable?" The king said, in a moment of, you know, a fierce temper, "I would give half of my kingdom if you make this guy miserable." "Okay," said the minister, "I need from you 10 gold coins." "What? Am I getting them back?" said the king. "No. But you will have your peace of mind." So he said, "You come with me." And he brought the king to a bush. It was evening, and from the bush they looked into the well-lit window of the servant. There he was. He had friends with him. His children were crawling over his laps. He was in best mood, laughing with his wife. and the friends and so on. And the minister said, do you really want to see him miserable? He turned around to the king who was next to him. Do you really want to see him miserable? Yes. I'm the king. I should be joyful. Why is he always so happy? He doesn't have anything. Okay, said the minister. And he took the little bag with the gold coins. He removed one gold coin and gave it back to the king and put the bag, or was hanging the bag on the door handle. Then he knocked very strongly, bong, 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 on the door and ran back to the bush. See what's happening now, said the minister to the king. So the man came out, looked around, saw nothing and no one, but when he wanted to go inside, he saw something was hanging at the door handle. He before entering, he opened the bag, and the minister and the king said, saw he was so surprised and so happy. 9 gold coins at that time were enough to pay for all the expenses of the family for the rest of their days. He was so happy. He looked around, he kneeled down and prayed to the god Ganesh. Oh Ganesh, you came by and you put this money on my door handle. I thank you very much. And he went in. Watch very carefully, said the minister. He went in, but he didn't tell anyone about the gold coins. He put them somewhere. He waited until his wife and the children went to bed, until his friends said goodbye. The light was still on. Look what is happening now, said the minister to the king. And he took out the gold coins, he heaped them on the table, and he counted. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. He looked around and he dove down on the ground. Where's the 10th? Where's the 10th gold coin? And 9 is not the right number. 10 is the right number. He couldn't find the gold coin because that was with the king. He again calculated. He again calculated. He became pensive. The next morning, the servant came into the sleeping room of the king, and he didn't greet the king with a joyful good morning. No, there was something in his mind. The disease of the, what is it? Not reached destination, the destination illness. That disease ate our poor man up. Everything would have been more than all right with 9 gold coins, but one was missing. And he could only see one missing. And therefore, he suffered. He became ill. He divorced his wife. Misery entered into his household. The illness of the missed destination is very great in our Western civilization. It's the source of all problems. We don't concentrate on what I have, but we concentrate on what I don't have. We don't concentrate on what I can do. We concentrate on what I cannot do. And this disease of the missed destination almost got me. I was so miserable when one attempt after the other failed, and we could not go down and reach daily in time. I thought of, oh, I'm missing a sacred festival day. Radhastami, it was, for those who know, a festival day. I missed my giving my seminar, and I could not see that I was in the midst of the most beautiful mountain range, that I was next to Mother Ganga. I forgot to say, we found a beautiful accommodation next to the Ganga, which was ideal. Only after some time, it was on that sacred day which I missed celebrating at the place where I wanted to celebrate it, but which I now celebrated in the mountains. Only on that day I became cured from this disease. I was celebrating Radhastami by myself. I was chanting ancient prayers, I was reading, I was singing songs, I had found my rock in the Ganga, a little in where the Ganga water flowed around. I spent the most wonderful time because I had freed myself from this disease, that I have to reach this certain goal in order to be satisfied. Life in this world does not go according to our plans, because if it would, we would be in control of all the atoms and the molecules and the destinies of people and so on. But we are not. We are not in control of the flow of natural event. We are not in control of other people's minds and decisions. And therefore, it always will behave, the future will behave different than on our planning board. That is a fact. And those of you who are a little elderly do know this already. I will come to an end now. I've seen Michael addressing all of you with his very good Michaelness. His accurateness, that we should send questions to him. I needed to become free from that illness, that only if my plans are fulfilled can I be happy. This is so wrong often. Your good fortune lies often outside of your mind. Yes, your good fortune lies outside of your thoughts and concepts and plans and so on. And my good fortune was to spend a most beautiful, fruitful spiritual time at the banks of Mother Ganga on a sacred holiday and so on. The second is, you need to how to deal with things that don't go your way. You need to think about what you might be able to do at this stage and not become overwhelmed by what you are not able to do. And the third thing which is required is you need to concentrate with your spiritual essence that is anyways not affected by material gain and material loss. I'm now need to turn to our generous host. I have a reflection exercise, a little meditation. Now I see we have 15 more minutes. Should I do it, or should we see if there are questions which we should ask now? What is your wise decision?
I think you can do the meditation.
Good. Yes, I will make, especially for this meditation. Is the sound good with this in the background, or is it too loud or too soft?
Good.
I want to request you to focus on two of our three cultural prompts. First, your full-hearted participation, and the second, your own resolve, your inner resolve or determination that you wish to make hopefully an experience that changes something in you. Good. Are we ready? Rasanath, ready? Rasanath looks like a saint with his virtual library there. I can already see a few books I know from there. Okay, let us sit tall, please, everyone. Close your eyes if you're comfortable, and release any distractions or concerns from your mind. In other words, tell yourself, I'm ready to make a spiritual experience. I do not need to do anything else. Now, direct your attention to your breathing. Feel the gentle rising and falling of your chest as you breathe in. Your chest rises, and as you breathe out, your chest falls a little bit back. I request you to do what is so helpful. Step out of your mind, your thoughts, by just connecting your mind or your awareness to each single inhale and each single exhale. Inhale on the count of three and exhale on the count of five. I will help you one time. In, one, two, three, out. One, two, three, four, five, six. Do this now on your own. Inhale on the count of three, exhale on the count of six. Should thoughts arise while you do this, simply let them go and return to your breathing. Good inhales. Longer exhales. Excellent. You're doing excellent. I can feel it through the computer. Next, release things that are happening in your life. Your job. Let go for a moment. Your roles as father, wife, friend, for a moment let go. Plans which you have made and desires, let go. And finally, just for a moment, let go even of your body in the sense that you are identifying with it. Sense the freedom, the vastness, and peace rise within you. Let those feelings, freedom, vastness, inner peace, expand and fill you. Rest in the space of open awareness. And then ask yourself gently, who am I when everything that is not me is gone? Or simply, who am I in my essence? As you ask this, draw your awareness deeper and still deeper inward. Notice moments of stillness that begin to emerge. And now tap into the underlying stillness, the very essence. Of who you really are, then everything that is not you is gone. Sense the aliveness within. Perhaps draw your awareness into the heart. How does it feel to simply be alive? Sense the vitality, feelings perhaps of contentment and inner strength. And focus on that inner spaciousness. I will read to you now an ancient text from the Upanishads. It's questions and answers. Please listen attentively. Who observes the world? Answer. The eye. Who observes the eye? The mind. Who observes the mind? Intellect. And finally, who is it that observes the intellect? Oh, Savya Sachin, it's the Atma, the immortal self. That self, that is who you are. For a moment, we just stay in this space. And when you feel it's time, again, focus on your ingoing and outgoing breath. Take your hands, rub them. Bring them gently to your eyes as if in palming. And then away from your eyes, looking into the lines of your hand as if you see them for the very first time. Welcome back. I do hope it was an experience for you. I sometimes don't know how well I can draw you into the experience over Zoom. But I think when we are determined and when we are fully participating something, some little thing can come through. So thank you very much. It is when you connect with this essence, that this eternal immortal self that is not disturbed by the thoughts and the cravings and the destination illness and the, oh, I must get this in order to be successful in my life. When you make contact with this, you can actually unplug. You can totally unplug. That is the new word I learned on my last visit to America, unplug. I think it's a very important word for the American politicians and Senate. So, Hare Krishna.
Thank you so much, Sachinanda Swami. What a gift you've given all of us. We are delighted to be transported by you into the story and then into a separate experience of the takeaway through your meditation. And I really appreciate some of the messages coming in to the chat. So thank you everyone for being with us. And if you have to leave now, of course we understand. Please join us again next week for the next part of the series. And the very last session, part 5, will be full Q&A. So please definitely be there and keep your questions with you. We may not be able to get to everybody each time, but that session is a perfect opportunity for asking your questions. And now, for those of you who are able to stay with us, we will go to your questions. So, Harsh, you may ask your question.
Thank you, Hari Prasad. So Swamiji, I was reflecting on one of the exercises that, or one of the questions that was given to us yesterday, and there was an incident where I felt angered by someone and betrayed, and I was wondering if those emotions are coming from my ego or some other place. How do I process those? Because I've learned that, I've learned about emotional intelligence, right? We've been asked, or we are taught, to process emotions in a healthy way. And I'm wondering, how does that play a role in our spiritual journey and a spiritual growth? What role emotions play, and how do we deal with them?
Thank you very much, Harsh. That was a very important question. There is something like righteous anger, which is free from ego. It's when we see that people hurt others. But many times ego is there in this anger. That's when we feel hurt by others. No? We don't think of others, we think of ourselves and our reaction. And that happens more often than not. So let me address this type of anger. To think that when I'm angry at my at the perpetuator of some bad activity, it will burn him, or I will mete out justice. It doesn't work like this. When you take a cup of poison and you drink it, it will be you who suffers, not the other. So if you have an anger based on your feeling hurt, then it's you who suffers, really, not the other person. What I would recommend to you, Harsh, is the emotional traffic light. A traffic light has stop, wait, and go. And I think it's in America, also like in Europe. Red is for stop, yellow is for wait, and green is for go. So when you feel a feeling like anger or lust or envy towards another person, first switch on red in your emotional traffic light. Careful, this is a strong emotion. It could be my undoing. Then switch on yellow. Wait. This waiting period is not an entirely passive time. It is a time where you think, what could be the appropriate response to this emotion? Should I not at all act on it and ignore it? Should I maybe speak about it with someone? What is the appropriate way to respond? And once you have decided on the most advantageous way how to respond, then only go to green, that is go. I think with this emotional semaphore is a Yugoslavian word, emotional traffic light, wars, divorces, quarrels of all kinds could have been avoided. Stop, see what is more appropriate, and only if you found the appropriate reaction, and go with it. That is my recommendation on your very, very pertinent question. Thank you, Harsh. I hope it satisfies you so, to some degree. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Harsh. Iti, you may ask your question, please.
Hi. It was really nice. Thank you for that. So while you were speaking, I realized that what's coming in my way of surrendering is being in a hurry, which comes from, I remember how Prasad called me out on this in our call, and it still stayed with me, is that I'm taking too much credit for the good things and the bad things in my life, because I always want to do something so that I can influence it. And then if I have a plan, I'm always in a hurry to execute that plan to arrive somewhere. And whenever I have a beautiful moment, it always comes with clarity, and it comes with just being calm and not in a hurry. Like, why I would want to hurry from a beautiful state? Like, I want to be there. And it's really nice to be in your presence, and you are not in a hurry at all. Like how you speak, I feel the same quality what I feel in my rare moments of just being there. And my question is that, is my observation correct?
Yes, and Diti, I have something, a jewel for you. See, to not hurry and rush away from a wonderful moment, but to dwell and stay with that moment is can be trained. We are all we are all formed by our habits. And in this modern civilization, yes, everyone rushes from one event to the next, to the next, to the next, to the next. And even if they get to the top, they will not be happy there, because the habit is to rush from, to rush on and on and on. You can train to relish four types of peace in you, four types of joy. The first is a very simple one. Let us say you have a beautiful moment with your friends and you eat a fresh apple or anything. And while this moment goes on, or these moments go on, just tell your mind, let me relish this time of being together, and make a conscious stop in your life where you really relish that little peace, that little joy in your life. Then let's go to the next thing. Maybe there's something in your life, like you look still young, like a student perhaps who makes an exam or passes successfully through an exam, then invite friends, celebrate that what you have obtained. So these are the goals which take a little longer to reach. Then we come to the third type of goal or peace or relishing the third type of peace. That is when you connect with the self, the eternal immortal, unchanging self. At that time, feelings of contentment will rise, of compassion towards others, feelings of conviction, what is your path in life, will rise. So stay with this, hold this a little bit. And finally, the fourth type of peace that can be relished or can be acknowledged is when you enter into the presence of God, perhaps in a prayerful moment or during a community celebration or anything like that. My point here is, unless you make it a habit to stop when some peace was given to you and hold on to it, keep it, relish it, consciously acknowledge it, express perhaps gratefulness for it. Unless you make that a habit, you will always rush by these good moments, and they are more or less inconsequential for your life because they come and go so quickly. make it a habit. Didi, you are like every human being, formed by the habits which you make. And if you wish to have a new habit, different from the rush-on habit which our modern civilization has, then you need to make the stop and relish exercise your best friend. Really, I so much pity these modern people who are always rushing on. They can never actually, even if something good happens for them, and there may be many, many good things that happen, they don't even notice it any longer because they only know one word: next, next, next. Good. I hope this answered your question to some degree of satisfaction, Diti.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you, Diti. We'll ask Amit to ask your question.
Thank you. Thank you for spending time with us. In your story, and in even micro events in life that have not the severity of the same size but similar decisions, there was effort also to try and go back and climb over the first landslide or the second landslide and there was some sense of responsibility also, and then there was also a shift to understand that that's not actually responsibility anymore, that's trying to get to the destination. And I really don't know how to separate the two things in terms of, you know, okay, where is the limit of the effort that I'm meant to put, and where is the appropriate time to step back and say what else maybe it is that I meant to do instead of trying the same thing again and again and again.
What a wonderful question, Amit. Really very relevant question, and I'm so grateful to receive all of your questions because I know you follow the session and understand what we wanted to communicate. Yes, when should I keep on endeavoring, and when is the time for me to stop my endeavor and cease any further effort, and also then look for all different ways where perhaps my treasures are. Amit, I wish to give a very practical answer, which is free from the burden of a lot of philosophy. There is a lot of philosophy around this question because it is an important question. I have one motto in life by which I live, and it is, I give my best and then leave the rest up to the Lord. So I try to do in every undertaking my best. What does this mean? I use my intelligence to find out. I make a physical effort. I take in the counsel of others who have gone the path before me. In this way, I use body, mind, senses, connections, whatever is given to me as a human being. And when I then see that despite my going along the road, in other words, despite my giving my best, I repeatedly reach the same dead end, then I look for other opportunities. In spiritual circles, there is the important number, it's three. So you make three efforts giving your best, and after the third you're not pushing through, of course you have to see if you have really used all your resources, and then you look for signs that there may be a different way for you to go. You will be surprised when you try your best and then are open for signs that may direct you in another direction. You will have the feeling that one door closes and somewhere else three doors open. then you know, woo, now it's time to let the closed door be closed and go through the open doors. Give your best and then look around, and often you will see other doors, other connections, in other words, other ways of doing, opening for yourself. We just have in our little ashram a situation where it would take too long, but we were in danger of losing our ashram. It was going to be sold, and I tried everything. I went to the owners and told them of our situation, that and so on. But then I could see, no, this is not the road to go by, and I closed the door. I did not negotiate any longer. And then all of a sudden, from an unexpected direction, help came, and the ashram was secured. So if I would have tried my own way, the other door would never have opened. So try your best, Amit. And then be detached. You can't do any more anyways than giving your best. You don't have anything more to give after you have given your best. Then it's, if you're not successful, it's not meant to come. And who says that your idea of and your design for a perfect life or good life or whatever is the right one? It is not so. Sometimes we see young men make endeavors to win the heart of a young lady. Not you, but this we see in life. And they're so determined, and they they harvest whole rose fields in order to put them on the street so that the beloved young lady can walk over roses and so on. But young lady always says, I don't like roses, gives signs of rejection. Then let the young man understand, this is not the perfect partner for me, and let him open his heart for other possibilities. I'm giving some modern example. Good. I thank you, Amit, and I hope this has helped you in some ways to find your own answer. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Amit. Rasanath has a related question. Please, Rasanath.
Thank you, Rasanath. Sometimes I find that I don't know what the difference between determination and destination illness is. Am I too attached to where I want to go, and at the same time, I fear that I may not be sincerely striving to get to what I need to do. So how do you discern between sincerity and being overly attached?
There is no, it really borders on Amit's questions. Thank you. Yes. That helps us to explore it more. It is not always so easy, because we do know that great things often were bought with the price of, please help me with if the word is not right, tenacity, thank you, tenacity. Everyone understands this word. It is, you know, really really being very, very committed to trying and not accept no or failure as something that would discourage me from my path. We all know there are in the history many, many examples. What comes to mind immediately to me is Prabhupada's. This is my own spiritual teacher whom Rasanath is very familiar with, efforts to land this ancient philosophy and lifestyle in America. You know, it was for the first year, there was very, very small response, and it was very difficult. And if he would have gone back and taken a ship back to India, yeah, there would be no Rasanath today. So yes, there is this. Please help us again with the word
tenacity.
Tenacity. I will look that up, because I know how it sounds, the word, but not how to write it or speak it properly. So. Rasanath, my only answer is it has to become crystal clear to you, and that happens over time. There are four ways in which every human being learns. One quarter of his learning is built by what he hears from a teacher, a guru, any type of teacher. The second 25% comes from discussions with other students about the subject matter. So discussions is very important. We are now with 50% of one's learning. An additional 25% of learning comes through self-study. No, where you study books, articles, lectures, podcasts on the subject matter. But the last and still missing 25% of what we learn comes over time. The time which it takes to mature. And some answers, like the ones which you were thinking about most properly, they do take the maturity that comes only through time. If you have a mango, a green mango, that becomes fully mature only over time. It won't become quicker mature if you pour more water on the roots. Yes, to pour a decent amount of water on the roots is important, but I'm speaking now after you have done it, it will not grow further. It needs to sit there on the tree. It needs to absorb over an amount of time the sun rays and do everything which a mango needs to do in order to mature and become a fully ripened mango. So, yes, try to learn from teachers, from other good friends, trusted friends with whom you can discuss, from self-study perhaps, or we could also say introspection, time of contemplation. But then we need to do what is most difficult for us, to be patient and let the answer mature in due course of time. Thank you very much. It is a great pleasure for me to see you, Rasanath, and I hope that this has given some satisfaction to your heart. Mm-hmm.
Yes, very much. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Rasanath. So we will close on that question. Sachinandana Swami, is there something that you would like to share as we come to our end?
Yeah. Even the most strongest oak tree was once a little nut who learned to stand and hold its ground. So when things don't go our way in life, never become discouraged, never enter the rank and file of the complainers who lament to destiny that the world doesn't go the way they want it to go. But stand your ground, stay, and after some time you will become an oak tree. That is my little poetic. By the way, that simile or that metaphor is not from my own poetic imagination. I don't know who said it, but I had written it down once. And so, yes.
Thank you again, Sachinandana Swami, for everything that you're offering us.